Reality is hard, morality is hard, and there are all these systems that offer us simplifications. So in each of these cases, what you get is some kind of offered trade-off where your values are thick and difficult, morality is thick and difficult, believing and adjusting your belief to the evidence is thick and difficult. And then there are systems or technologies or promises that offer you to flatten out this stuff, make it easier, and it's more pleasurable, it's more delicious, and that's the trade I'm worried about.
Hello, and welcome to the Insight Podcast from the Zion Canyon Mesa, a residency center for the arts and humanities in Springdale, Utah, surrounded by Zion National Park. I'm your host, Logan Hebner. Today, we'll tap into the agile mind of philosopher T. Wen for our first podcast in a series called The Anthropology of Truth. No need, I think, to get into what inspired this series, why we believe it's important. We all saw what went down over the last 4 years, a daily assault on truth, facts, and science. What happened? Where are we now? How do we recover? Can we recover? I knew it was all out there. Racism, stupidity, fears and anxieties ripe for the plucking by wannabe autocrats. It combined P.T. Barnum's "There's a sucker born every minute" and Lincoln's "Some of the people all the time." But the shock for me was that some of the people turned out to be closer to most of the people. Trump got over 74 million votes. He almost got reelected. Okay, I get that a lot of those votes were single-issue people, anti-abortion, gun rights, the wealthy all holding their noses while voting. And of course, the racists, the white paranoia that we are getting, quote-unquote, replaced. And for them, each day during the 8 years of Obama pulled that bowstring back a little further. And I get the 2016 election, not liking Hillary, the alluring narrative of a successful businessman, a billionaire, a consummate dealmaker draining the swamp. I get all that. But what I'm interested in and what scares me is that over the next 4 years, there were almost daily "did you see that" moments with the relentless churn of lies, misstatements, the sex scandals, his obsession with Russia and other dictators, and most importantly, the sheer incompetence of it all. It just bounced off of people. And within and throughout all of it, the truth was getting beaten senseless. And I'd experienced Teflon Ron Reagan. Before he even knew he had Alzheimer's, there were these gaps. He twice toasted Maggie Thatcher at a ceremonial dinner. His concluding argument in a debate made no sense, but he looked so good saying it. But this feels different than that. It feels like something deeper, harsher, more dangerous happened there and is still happening. The chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, well aware of Russian tactics, pointed out that we were lucky that Trump was a buffoon. What if he were actually an intelligence-skilled demagogue like Putin? I lived through the 60s, had a draft number for Vietnam. I remember Nixon in my blood. But we all had the same information then from just three television networks and a handful of wire feeds. So even if the information was wrong, we all worked with the same story. So we were all screaming and fighting with each other on the same roller coaster with Walter Cronkite. Fast forward to today, where I was monitoring a subreddit of MAGAs and never-Trumpers trying to honestly dialogue with each other. What struck me was how they couldn't even begin a conversation because they couldn't agree on the same set of facts or histories. Nixon was surrounded by people of integrity. Elliot Richardson as Attorney General, Mike Mansfield in the Senate, the Warren Court. What if Nixon had sycophants like Bill Barr, Mitch McConnell, and the Roberts Court? And most importantly, what if Nixon had Fox News to shill for him? I cannot imagine it. And fortunately, we don't have to. But despite the deep breath, the profound relief that I feel anyway with this new administration, these darker undercurrents have been unleashed. What now? I spent 5 years working projects with the Soviet Union. Virtually every statement that came from government was a lie. Every statement supported a tactic and a strategy, all designed to bolster and sustain power. Catherine the Great's lover Potemkin became infamous for his fake portable villages, built for Catherine to enjoy in her travels. That devolved into a grotesque Russian art called pokazuka, roughly for show, a social theater, a farce that everyone participated in. The Romanian dictator Ceausescu would commemorate closed factories and abandoned villages by busing people in to act as cheering crowds. He had the dead leaves on the trees painted green. My dealings with Soviet officials carried an unmoored, unhinged sense that I could feel on my skin. It was like being in an asylum. In conversations with my Russian friends, who were of course painfully aware of all of this, a core rap emerged, pinpointing the Magna Carta of 1215 as ground zero for democracy. Countries with that lineage, such as the U.S., benefit from a jumpstart towards equal rights and democracy. Countries without that, like Russia, were 800 years behind. And arguably, the U.S. Constitution, rife with fresh ideas of freedom and equality, turbocharged our last 245 years to create a concrete foundation, a firewall, a bulwark against all that I had witnessed and felt in the Soviet Union. So I felt pretty smug that it would never happen here. And then it was. I experienced those same physical feelings repeatedly over the last 4 years, like hanging onto a raft about to flip in a rapid. Centuries of tradition, education, a free press, pursuing the truth, all about to keel over, just like that. You could say, well, that was all a fluke. We survived it. We were never even that close to North Korea with its bizarre cult of personality. The birth of their dear leaders bringing spring from winter, then walking at 3 weeks old, talking at 8 weeks, then shooting 11 holes in one in the first time ever playing golf. But I ask you, what could be crazier than believing that the Democratic Party harbors a cabal of Satan-worshipping, cannibalistic pedophiles running a global child trafficking ring that only Donald Trump could rescue us from? What could possibly be more insane than QAnon? So, yes, manipulating people's fears and anxieties to control them, to control us, is as old as we are. But it feels like something different lurks here within the complexities of technology and the allures of social media. So what is old here? And what is new? I always believe that truth rings out somehow, that it persists even in the darkest days and eventually comes to light. But in the Soviet Union, it felt like in certain circles, the truth had simply been beaten to death. Today, I'm just not sure about any of it. Hence this podcast series as a way to start exploring all this. I can't think of a better way to begin than with the philosopher Ti Huen. From his solid background in classic Western philosophy, which he teaches at the University of Utah, Ti has scoured our contemporary landscape to address these very questions. He's concocted a heady mix of social media, echo chambers, the dynamics of pornography, game theory, and quantification, all rooted in traditional philosophy, to shed some light on our current dilemma. Please check our show notes for links to his videos and papers. So welcome to Insight, and let's jump right in. T, somehow you have pulled together a really compelling paradigm for what's going on right now. And with seemingly disparate aspects like echo chambers, pornography, gamification, and quantification. So let's start with echo chambers. Just jump right in. Let's go ahead and start wrapping on echo chambers, and let's see where we go.
Yeah. So, so I did some work on echo chambers, and I hadn't really intended to. Like, I'm supposed to be a very traditional epistemologist working in like very traditional questions of how does a person know? And if you don't know the history of philosophy about epistemology and the study of knowledge, like a lot of it has traditionally been about the individual. How does the individual know? How does the individual sure of themselves? And this whole idea that actually we might be dependent on these like vast social networks that are kind of out of our control is kind of a new idea in philosophy. And I think not just philosophy. To a lot of the world still has this, to me, what now seems to me like a fantasy, and that fantasy is like you can think for yourself. You can know everything for yourself. You can figure out everything for yourself. But if you actually think about the structure of knowledge, and I mean, I think about this a lot when I think about climate change denial and vaccine denial, and a lot of the echo chambers work for me came from these moments where friends of mine would be like, oh, look at these climate change denialists, look at these vaccine denialists, how could you be so stupid? And I was like, no, I mean, I am not a climate change denialist or a vaccine denialist, but it doesn't seem like just brute idiocy to me. It seems like something else. It seems like, because in the end, I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you the math behind climate change. I can't tell you how climate change models work. I can't tell you the statistical analysis of vaccines. What instead happens is that I trust these massive extended networks of scientists. And it's not just that I trust, it's not just that I trust someone. It's like, I don't even know who I trust. Because, like, I mean, think about this, right? So think about how much trust is involved when you get on a plane. Okay, you get on a plane, you could die, but you're on this plane, and you get on the plane because you trust that the aeronautical engineers have done all the right checks, right? So how are they doing that? Well, they're using various instrumentation. Who made the instrumentation? Instantly now, your life is in the hands of people. You don't even know who they are. You don't know who their specialties are. You can't even check them, right? So my wife is a chemist. She's a PhD in chemistry. And I asked her while I was working on this stuff. I was like, so how much do you understand of like the statistics you rely on? She was like, I don't understand any of that. I don't even understand like neighboring fields of chemistry, right? So here's this background. We have this vast network of trust. And then something can manipulate that, right? Think about the power that someone has if they can send our trust down the wrong channels.
Right, so, we're trust consumers.
We have to be. That's the weird thing, right? In some deep sense, we have to be consumers, right? The idea that I could actually, I mean, there are more and less responsible ways I can start my trust. But the idea that I can manage where my trust goes in every single place that it runs it's impossible, right? Not in this era. Elijah Milgram, who's a philosopher who's really inspired me on this stuff, says that basically, like, our era is the era of extreme hyper-specialization, where every single piece of knowledge is now, like, dependent on chains of, like, thousands of domains and specialties, like hundreds of thousands of people. We can't track where that is, right? So Annette Beyer, one of the great philosophers of trust, says that trust makes us vulnerable. And a lot of us, I think, can't cope with how vulnerable trust makes us. So at this point, so the echo chambers thing is, against this background, I was reading this stuff. I remember reading this paper, and it was like, science has proved that echo chambers don't exist. And I was like, wait, what? Hold on a second. Like, look at reality. So I looked at this paper, and what the paper said was they'd done network models where they were tracking people's clicks and links. And they were like, look, liberals on Twitter and Facebook click on conservative articles, and conservatives on Facebook and Twitter click on liberal articles, so there are no echo chambers. And I'm like, wait, that's way too simplistic. So I went back and I went looking at a lot of the old sociology and this stuff, and I discovered that there are actually two different concepts that people are blurring together. So the old concept is an echo chamber. And this was, to my mind, most clearly introduced in Kathleen Jamison and Frank Capella's book, Echo Chamber, which is a study of Rush Limbaugh and Fox News. And what they say is that an echo chamber is a system of manipulated trust where people on the inside have been taught to distrust everyone on the outside. So later on in the history, this is a little bit earlier, this is like early 2000s. Later on, there's a bunch of thinking, but most clearly from Eli Pariser. He has this book called The Filter Bubble. And he's about how, you might not ever hear arguments from the other side because everyone in your social network has the same beliefs as you. And the filtering mechanisms are like filtering what you see. So these get merged together. And if you look at the journalism and the sociology that combines this stuff, people just start talking about the filter bubble, right? Just about the fact that you haven't encountered anything. And all these arguments I was seeing that it doesn't exist are all about the filter bubble. They're just showing that liberals actually do see conservative arguments, and conservatives actually do see liberal arguments. But if you remember the old concept, showing that there's no filter bubble does nothing to show that there's no echo chambers.
Right. So you're laying out two ideas here. One, that there's a filter bubble that is there are algorithms lurking under all of this. So you've got your information coming to you, but you've brought in another, as you started with trust. So an echo chamber does two things. It doesn't just can sort of limit your information, but it also hacks your trust so that the other becomes an enemy. It learns how to reject outside information, and the stronger that that outside, there's something incredibly self-reinforcing about echo chambers. And you use the term evidential preemption. Could you talk about that a little bit?
So one thing I want to say about what you just said is, I just want to be clear. An echo chamber limits your information, but it doesn't do it by limiting exposure. It doesn't limit what you see. It limits what you trust.
Yeah, it poisons the other sources.
Yeah, it poisons them. And I think this is clear. So if you go online, you look at like climate change denialists, it's not like they haven't heard the arguments. They're they know what the arguments on the other side are.
Right, they're really good at them.
Right, they have these – they have undermining arguments.
Right.
They have things like, look, you can't believe that source. Like, that source is in the grip of mainstream
George
media
Soros.
In the midst of – Soros, right? It's like some conspiracy theory. So evidential preemption is this idea I got from a philosopher, Andre Begbie, that helped explain to me what was going on. So – in evidential preemption is one of the major tools, I think, of an echo chamber. And evidential preemption is the idea that, so let's say that we're in an echo chamber and I am the leader of the echo chamber, right? By the way, I should just say something I forgot to say. If you read Jameson Capella, what they make clear is that echo chambers aren't structures of informational isolation. They say basically that their structures are like cults, right? Of like this hyper-centralized trust where your trust in the outside world is totally broken. It's all directed inside. So let's say that I'm the leader of an echo chamber and you trust me already. I say, when you go out and read that mainstream media, you know, that New York Times is going to tell you that I'm in the pay of big oil, but don't believe them. They're just a conspiracy. So what I've given you is I've given you an explanation that lets you ward off incoming evidence. But at the same time, I've also wrapped that in a prediction. I've said something like, when you go out and you see that New York Times, they're going to give you an argument undermining me. And then you go out and you see that, and that actually confirms my words. Like, I have now made a prediction about the world. And that prediction has been fulfilled. So not only does it disarm incoming evidence, but it reinforces the belief structure.
The best I ran into is some of the fundamental religious people that when they start to question their faith and those thoughts start to enter, those thoughts have been stamped as the devil. Right. So anytime you start thinking about that belief, you nuke that idea because it's the devil. Sort of self-cauterizing in a way.
Yeah, I mean, if the structure you're looking for an echo chamber is a structure where every contrary source has been somehow labeled malicious and possibly with some kind of like large-scale confirming worldview behind it. I mean, this is what the conspiracy theory is doing, right? And so every time, if I've successfully labeled every source of contrary evidence as malicious, and I've given you a model of the world such that you expect that maliciousness, then every time you see it, you're going to confirm the model. And this is one of the really important things for me. People in echo chambers are not unthinking, right? This is manipulated rationality. And in fact, what they're doing looks like, I mean, the model that I see out there, a lot of people have are, oh, if you're an echo chamber, oh, if you're on the inside, like, oh, you're just, you know, you're nuts. You're not thinking at all. And this looks to me, this is maybe a cartoon version, but a version of science. You have a model, you're testing it, you're gathering evidence, and then when your model is confirmed, you increase your belief in the model. So I'm really worried in a lot of these cases that the model is like too sticky. That's the problem.
Right. So something that I think will go throughout this conversation is that any number of processes, alarm systems, thinking mechanisms, they get shallow. There's this imitation that kind of comes in and takes its place. So to quote you, and I love the way you put this, let's be the evil actor. Let's bring him in. And what you want to do is sort of preempt, short circuit, or hack these processes so people feel very confident that they've thought critically, really considered these things, and then they lay it down as cement and don't revisit it. So the way you put it is it maximizes the feel of ideas sliding into place, the feel of seeing connections, the capacity to generate explanations, and a sense of communicability, and indeed, as you said, a sense of community. Now you belong to this community of people that all know this. So it's not Orwellian doublespeak, as you point out in your writing. It's not just an opposite thing. There's something that's coming in on top of those processes that can be very deep and very nuanced, and making them very easy, making them use a junk food analogy a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the junk food analogy keeps coming back to me. This idea that, like, look, so this basic ruling thought for me has been like, look, we love sugar, we love salt, we love fat, and we love crispiness. And it's not like these have always been terrible things to pursue, right? Like, so in my youth, I was really interested in evolutionary psychology. And there's this basic notion that you can understand a lot by thinking about the environment of evolutionary adaptedness, right? So we are creatures that are, you might think, born or with this intense, no-ceilinged love of, like, sugar and salt and fat. And the reason is because in the kind of environment that we spent most of our evolutionary lives in, you could never get enough of that stuff, right? So you could just pursue that. And now something else has happened. Now, like, large-scale corporations can precisely target those qualities and have changed the environment such that our heuristics don't quite work. Right. So this is one of my big worries about basically, like, so my basic worry is, like, about the manufacture of brain junk food, right? And what that looks like is, okay, so the stuff you read is from this paper, Seductions of Clarity, that I wrote pretty recently. And the idea there is, okay, imagine for the moment that you're a malicious actor. How would you get people to accept a belief system, even if it was kind of weak? One way you could do it is if you could get people to not think about the belief system, right? So how do you do that? So I have a theory that is based in reading a lot of empirical work in sociology and a lot of stuff in cog psych. So let me just lay out the theory. So the theory is that we're all cognitively limited beings and we can't think about everything all the time, right? There's a billion things to think about.
Right.
You don't have time to investigate everything. So as cognitive science will tell you, whenever you have things that are too complex and you're a limited being, you need heuristics. You need quick and dirty rules for getting through things. What we need is some very quick way of evaluating what's important to think about and what's not important to think about.
Right.
So the theory I have, and this is partially built from work in the philosophy of education and in the psychology of education, is that we use a feeling of clarity or a feeling of understanding as a heuristic for when we've thought enough. And we use a feeling of confusion as a heuristic for knowing when we should think more. So if someone can give something the feeling of clarity, so if a manipulator, if we're the manipulators, let's be the manipulators, and we can, like, get our belief system and give it the feeling of clarity and the feeling of understanding, then it'll trigger the heuristic and people will stop thinking about it. So what does that look like? So there's actually this really cool literature from the philosophy of education and the philosophy of science about the nature of understanding, which is based in the history of science and the history of education. Anyway, sorry. You know, you can read the paper if you want to know where all I'm just trying to show you that this is not like a philosopher making up bullshit. Like, this is a philosopher reading a lot of, like, empirical junk.
And I have to jump in here and say that you do discuss the philosophy of bullshit in some of your pages. What's his name? Bogert?
It's Harry Frankfurt.
Frankfurt. And there's actually a philosophy of bullshit that you dive into that I really enjoy.
Yeah, we can talk about that. The stuff I'm talking about is, like, super
Go close. Ahead.
So what the philosophy of understanding says is, okay, back in the day, philosophers used to think what was important was knowledge. And knowledge is just knowing, like, whether or not you know particular claims. And in that work, everyone just looked at individual claims and were like, do you know this or not? So the new thought is, and this is from people thinking really hard about how science works, that that actually isn't what scientists are doing. Scientists aren't trying to get individual bits of knowledge. They're trying to get something more holistic. So this holistic thing is called understanding. So the basic view is that when you have understanding, you don't just possess a lot of random facts that you know. You have a systematic, holistic model. And what are the signs that you have an understanding? One sign is, oh, you had all this stuff that you couldn't organize before, and when you get an understanding, it all organizes. This feel like things locking into place. Also, once you have the understanding, you can make predictions. You can quickly explain new things and make predictions, right? And you can communicate your understanding. You can talk to someone and get the model that's in you over to them. So there's this basic view of understanding. Now, if I'm right, then people use the feeling of understanding as a heuristic that they're done with their investigation. So if you want to simulate that, then what you want to do is simulate the feeling of things locking into place, of suddenly being able to make sense of the world, of the world being coherent. Right. And what that looks like to me is, so one, conspiracy theories do that, right? When you have a conspiracy theory, you suddenly have this incredibly powerful thing that like reorganizes the world to one perfect simple unity. And you're probably, for the purpose of our current conversation, you may be less interested in this, but I think another example is standardized bureaucratic language. So in a lot of the world that I move in, which is higher education, there are standardized terms for student success that actually, they kind of make...
That's a quantification stuff.
Yeah, this is the quantification stuff. So like, the truth is, every discipline educates their students in a totally different way, and standardized terms are bunk. But if you have standardized language and you've been taught a system to apply it, then it feels like you understand things easily because you can apply those terms swiftly to any data and then yield a conclusion that other people in the system treat as a justification for action. And it feels like you understand.
Right. So let's within that, there's something that's always fascinated me is the deeper you get into the conspiracy theory, the more radical the cognitive dissonance can become. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about cognitive dissonance, because there are people that when they're deep in a theory, they'll tell you that Osama bin Laden was murdered by Martians, and they'll also tell you that he's still alive. There was one just the other day where they were questioning DeJoy from the post office. Or one of his folks, and they were bragging about how great the post office service was. And then the senator asked, so given that, then there was no mail fraud during the election, right? Dead silence. You know, that somehow people are able to hold these very conflicting ideas in their head at the same time without going crazy within a given conspiracy theory. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you start thinking about conspiracy theories, you have to be really careful immediately. And the first place to be careful is not to think that all conspiracy theories are bad. And I think this is – it is a seductively clear but false belief is that, oh, if someone believes in the conspiracy theory, then we must know that they're nuts. Because some conspiracy theories are true. This is so
just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
Right. So we know that there's a history of real conspiracies in the world. So the move you can't make the I mean it would be so nice if we were just like, oh, anyone that believes in conspiracy theory is great. But there's Nixon, right? CIA is real conspiracies. No, I mean, if here's a place where it's totally legitimate to believe that the world outside of you is ridden by a conspiracy and that is filled full of conspiracies, and that you need to ignore most of what the mainstream media is telling you. If it was 1938 Germany, and you're like,
right,
there is a conspiracy, right? So there's this basic problem. I mean, what looks to you like dissonance? I think how about this? A lot of people think your view of conspiracy theories is that there's too much cognitive dissonance. I actually worry that worry with conspiracy theories is there's too much cognitive clarity. Right? Like the dissonance comes, it seems like dissonance to you because they're refusing to believe things that are obvious facts. But if part of the belief system is, well, you can't believe the mainstream media because X, Y, and Z, right?
Yeah, but let's revisit it one more time. I'm talking about within a conspiracy theory that people are able to hold clearly opposing ideas, truths, quote unquote, in their heads at the same time, and somehow they don't crash into each other and crash the system.
I mean, we may be thinking about slightly different targets. Some people don't think things through carefully, right? And some people accept large amounts of contradictions. But I think this is common to a lot of people in the world, like believing very contradictory things and not thinking them through. I mean, I can take most students, be they liberal or conservative, in an echo chamber or not, and start producing contradictions in what they believe, right? Lots of people have that. The worry with me with echo chambers, in many cases, that there's a leap to a system of thought. I mean, maybe try this. Okay, let me try to integrate your worry and my thought. I think sometimes what's happening is my worry is that the attraction to this world-spanning explanation that makes sense of everything, that system's prettiness and beauty overwhelms particular observations and particular pieces of evidence.
So another thing is that, and we'll get to this later, but we'll start sort of shading towards it, is what is driving this, and what is driving this so particularly hard right now? And there's two ends of this, and you talk, use the word hedonism, and with junk food, it's still, you know, it's sugar, it's grease, it's butter, it's lovely, it's delicious. But you also termed a couple of beautiful existential phrases. You say existential value torture and the value horror of a pluralistic world.
Right.
So there's something not just pulling us towards, but there's something. I submit that there's something about this moment that we're experiencing where a lot of this stuff is just on fire, and we really need to figure it out. Do you want to say anything about what's sort of roiling and simmering underneath us right now that's driving this particularly hard right now, or if you think it is?
I am so torn about this. There are times when I look at the history and I think, oh, this is nothing special. Like, There are moments like this all the time.
Sure.
And there are moments where I think, no, something's going on right now, and it has to do with a particular technology of the moment. This is something we should talk about. I keep finding new information that changes my mind about whether this is systemic or asymmetrical, whether it is something that infects everyone across the world, or whether it's more concentrated around certain. I mean, and I'm thinking like Fox News, Breitbart, right?
And technology, you know, high tech.
Right. So one story you could tell, and this is the story I've told them. So we talked a little about this before over email. These two things I wrote about Twitter and gamification and moral outrage porn. There's this basic worry I have that we're often being offered bargains, and the bargain is a bargain that where we will get a ton of pleasure and a ton of motivation and a ton of energy and a ton of satisfaction if we accept a simpler value system, or if we accept a simpler picture of the world. So two quick things. So Becca Williams and I wrote this paper called Moral Outrage Porn.
Right. If I can interject real quickly, we're about to shift from, let's wrap up the echo chamber and shift right into porn and moral outrage porn.
Okay.
And I'm going to quote you again. I love quoting you. So to sum up, let me add anything you want. But the echo chamber, it creates a sense of clarity that can be used to end thinking. And it's a useful point of vulnerability for thought hacking, with two methods, oversimplifying explanations and also oversimplifying numbers, which we'll get to. So is there anything else you want to try to, you feel needs saying that we've created our echo chamber and people get what it is?
I mean, there's a billion things to say.
Well, I think the thing about your writing that really strikes me getting deeper and deeper into it is the self-reinforcing, self-protecting mechanisms that echo chambers employ to keep you in them and to ward off any way of getting out of them. Okay, so that's our echo chamber. So let's move to porn and moral outrage porn. Go ahead. You were just starting to talk about the paper you wrote
With Becca. So
yeah,
this paper actually starts as a late night drunk Facebook conversation on someone else's thread.
What else is new?
Yeah, right. This is how academia works now. This is. I mean, I think you would be shocked to realize, people outside of academia might be shocked to realize how many ideas start at 2 a.m. on Facebook with two drunk philosophers being like, "Hey, this is funny." I was just like gassing for a while about how there's this new usage of porn that everyone knows but isn't well defined. And this is like the usage we have in like food porn and food porn, real estate porn, organization porn, poverty porn, ruin porn. So like denim porn. Like people will just say this and you know immediately what they mean, right? So my wife, when she gets stressed out, she goes to this site that she loves called thingsneatlyorganized.tumblr.com. It's like, it's a Tumblr just of like, you know, beautifully organized pencils. And this is obviously like organization porn. So Beck and I were like, well, you know, we're philosophers. We want a definition of porn in this like new sense, right? This like larger sense. And we found one. So Michael Ray has this paper about sexual pornography where he suggests that what sexual pornography is using images of sex for immediate gratification but not trying to advance intimacy or relationships. And I mean, he was really interested in the fact that like a couple, like romantic lovers, could exchange nude pictures as part of their relationship. And that's not porn. That's something else, right? That's part of their relationship. Porn is, his essential insight was something like, porn is like the images for gratification cut out of the complexity of a long developing relationship. So Becca actually found this definition and she was like, wait, I think this generalizes. And so I imagine people thinking about philosophers talking about like really like romantic meaning of life stuff. Most of the time we're like, does this definition generalize? Anyway, so we were like, look, I think we can make this more general. So here's our suggestion. What it is to be porn in the generic sense is, you're using something as porn if you're using a representation for immediate gratification while avoiding the costs and consequences of entanglement with the real thing. So food porn, you don't need to eat it or buy it or deal with the nutrition. You just look at it, right? Real estate porn, you like just look at it and you're like, cool couches, but you don't have to take care of it or buy it.
Right.
And of course, our big point was to claim that, okay, there's also morality porn. There's moral outrage porn, which is representations of outrage that are used for immediate gratification while avoiding the costs and consequences of actual moral action. And I just want to be clear. A lot of people immediately misread us and are like, oh, you mean that moral outrage is bad. And we're like, no, 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 no. What we mean is real moral outrage that makes you actually think about what you're doing and actually act is amazing. The problem is the porn version tries to get you to act, either to not act or to act on a simplification because it's more pleasurable. I also want to say this is the paper of mine that I think people have misread the most. And Beck and I were super careful to be like, look, it's not just outrage. That's one version. Here's another version. Civility porn.
Right.
You can like, oh my God, like all those crazy outrage people, like they're so uncivil. Like I'm just like, we should be all that. Any form of morality, any content of morality could be pornified. What pornification involves is a simplified representation where the simplification is made for some kind of pleasure. Well, actually, let me just be definite. It doesn't have to be simplified, but almost all the cases I've seen in reality, the pleasure comes from a simplification.
Well, I like how you put it. I think you wrote it without the hard stuff. So it's that pleasure without the complexities, responsibilities, costs, or consequences.
Yeah.
So you're in this disembodied, you're on your computer, and you're being outraged or tweeting outrage. Yeah. And so, and then you hit on how uniquely powerful moral outrage is. And if you could address that.
I mean, I think what you're talking about is, one of the data points that we know is that expressions of simple moral outrage on Twitter go viral more than anything else. They have
four times, you said.
Yeah, four times. That's data. It's cited in the paper.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. And my view is something like condemnation. So this is just a guess, right? So this is just an empirical data point. I don't have a good explanation for it. My guess is that the associated pleasures of condemnation are feeling smug, right? Feeling assured, feeling that you're completely in the right, feeling that you're on unquestionable footing, and that any kind of, I mean, I think maybe outrage is the wrong central notion here, but just confidence.
And again, we're touching on this idea of flattening and shallowing, that there's something coming in between us and the deeper feeling that's just sort of flattening out the real civil discourse.
Right.
You know, this theme is continuing.
I mean, actually, I don't – again, I'm not – the claim here is not that we should not be morally outraged.
Oh, understood.
And – I mean, I've actually, the thing I've been tracking the most lately is versions of this with, oh, we should be civil with one another, which also have the same kind of like flattening, simplifying view, right, where like everyone that's angry is bad and everyone that's civil is good and has like.
And the civil person is feeling those same feelings of smugness and rightness
as
the moral outrage people.
Right.
It's just as flat and just as sugary and junk foody.
Right. I mean, the thing that a worrying sign of this is something like, I think any moral system that makes living in this world easy. I mean, there's some easy. There are terrible people out there, and some judgments are easy. But if it makes, but life is like thick and complicated, and trying to live in a world with people with deeply different values who are all trying to be free is going to be incredibly painful. And if you have a moral system or a moral code that is going to make all that simple, then I think it's much more likely that that system was designed or evolved for the sake of our pleasure than it is that's going to get at the moral truth.
All right. I love what you said when you spent a couple of months reading comments on Breitbart. and your comment was you wanted to die.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That's pretty miserable.
Yeah. So you use another good term that I liked, and it's a cartoon morality.
Yeah.
And the idea of cartoons, it invoked in me these moments where you see people take these echo chambers and these flattened outrages, and they inject themselves into the world. The guy going into the Cosmos Pizza with an AK-47 to save the children from being eaten by Satan-worshipping Democrats. The goofy looks of the guys in the Michigan legislature with their cosplay, but real AK-47s. You know, whenever these burst into reality, there's a cartoonish feel to it.
I mean, my experience, part of the reason I'm still looking for an explanation of why things are accelerating is it does feel like, and maybe sometimes people just tell me I haven't read enough history, but it does feel like the explosion of completely cartoonish belief systems into the public sphere in the way that you indicate is accelerating.
Yes.
And I don't, I mean, back to your question about why is it going on now? I don't have a good answer for you. One theory is that, if you want to, here's a technological explanation, but let me give it and then immediately worry about it. So the technological explanation is something like a lot of this stuff is the result of the manipulation of communication for the sake of engagement. So I think it's just the idea like, look, companies like Facebook and Twitter, they're responding to an incentive that the more people spend time on there and the more they click, the better. And so what gets us to click and spend time is various cartoonish processes. So if you believe those two things, then you'd expect that as companies get better at micro-targeting this stuff and as technology improves, I mean, it's like, look, fast food's gotten more addictive. Why? Because companies have spent enormous amounts of money getting better and better at targeting whatever makes us addicted to chips.
These cigarettes are great.
Yeah, they're awesome. I literally can't buy chips and have them in my house because chips have gotten so good. I mean, whatever. I respond. I'm not saying I'm above this stuff. Twitter gets in my head and chips get barbecue chips have gotten so finely targeted that a lot of us go into a fugue state and we just cram it into our mouths.
But I rationalize that by eating salsa with them. It's just a delivery system for something healthy.
So the work of mine that you've been reading is all on the side of social epistemology and the philosophy of political philosophy. Yes. But I also do aesthetics. Half my life is doing the philosophy of art. I think they're really related because I think that philosophy of art is where we got this analysis of pornography. And something that's really similar, this may interest you, the discussion of the nature of pornography actually has this collision with another old discussion about the nature of sentimental art. And sentimental art is basically, there's this idea that look, real art is open and ambiguous and thoughtful. And there's this other thing that people worry about, sentimental art. And I mean, I think people are thinking about Hallmark movies or Thomas Kincaid stuff. And the hallmark of sentimental art, according to this old account, is it has a mechanistic relationship to your feelings. So one old idea is you go to the art, real art, you go to have it, have your own reaction to it or struggle to understand what it means. But sentimental art, you're I want this feeling. I'm going to go to this feeling. And the art reliably provokes that feeling. So one version of this is the tearjerker. You just want to go and cry. Another version of this, so this gets adapted. The literature we were using on sexual pornography actually draws on this idea. The idea is that the difference between – so this really interesting discussion about the difference between erotic art and pornography. One of the ideas is they're both sexual in a way. But erotic art, you can have all kinds of reactions to it. You can, and the reactions arise from particular subtle details of it. Where pornography is supposed to be something, so Jerry Levinson has this paper where he's with pornography, you just walk into it and you want it to do its job and get out of the way. You just want, and so I do have a worry that duality between something richer and more open and then this thing that's just there to jerk one feeling out of you, that's the thing that we're looking at when we're looking at the moral outrage porn stuff.
So we've been to the echo chamber. Now we've sort of tied porn and moral outrage porn, the different kind of porns, again, a flattening out of the real thing. And somehow they seem to come together very naturally on social media. Yep. I don't know if you want to address that now, or maybe we should talk about gamification and quantification first, because that's
Let's talk about all that together. So this is part of the question of why this stuff is taking off right now. And one of my worries is that the technological platforms for communication are getting better at deliveries for this kind of brain candy that we've been talking about, and making it easier to make these trades of simplification for simplifying one's moral system for pleasure. This stuff for me comes out of a lot of research I was doing into the nature of games. So I spent 6 years of my life trying to understand how games work, and I wrote this book, Games Agency as Art, which is mostly very pro-game. It's games are this really interesting art form that manipulates agency so that we can experience ourselves acting. But a core way, one of the core appeals of games is they make the world incredibly clear for a moment, right? So in normal life, there are hundreds of values, thousands, millions, they're ambiguous, they're difficult, I'm trying to survive in COVID, take care of my mental health, take care of my partner's mental health, get my work done, take care of my kids, make sure my kid has a good life, get enough exercise, continue to research, take care of my students, all this stuff. And how do I compare these values? Sometimes it's my kid wants to play with me, or I could sneak off for a workout. How do I compare all this stuff? It's super hard. But in games, for a moment, there's one goal. You know what it is. You know exactly how to get it. You know exactly how well you've done. In my life, I'm trying to raise a good kid. How the hell do I know if I'm succeeding? Here's this person that's happily, destroying, part of my health. Am I succeeding or failing? I don't know.
I don't know. Who knows?
But who knows?
It's clarity. It's the clarity.
Yeah.
But in games, every direction. You know. And it's not just winning. It's the clarity of losing and the clarity, what did you call it? The delicious struggle, I think, is your phrase.
Yeah. So the struggle is delicious in games partially because this ambiguity has been pushed out. Like, you know, right. I won. I lost. I'll try again. Oh, I did better. Right? I know.
Or, exactly, oh, I lost. I get to feel that too.
Right.
So clear.
That's actually, I hadn't even thought about that. But it is true that, like, when you've lost a game, you've definitively lost.
Oh, yeah.
In this life, it's like, did I fail or not? I don't know.
Yeah, was when the ref makes a bad call, you get to feel that was unfair. Everything, right. Everything about it's very clear.
Right. No, that's right.
And it's full spectrum.
Yeah, you know what the rules are. You know what the points are. The entire world is, like, normatively delineated, and it just makes sense. And so I think this is great in games because it's temporary and you get to experience this, and it concentrates the beauty of things. But it's great when you step into and out of it temporarily. But I'm really worried about gamification systems. So I'm thinking about gamified work and gamified education. But in the specific case you're referencing, I'm really worried about the gamification of Twitter because I think it's turning discourse into a game. And the way it's doing that is it's giving you the clarity and pleasure of a game, but it's doing it by getting you to narrow and simplify your goals. But not in a board game you just play with your friends, in like reality on Twitter. Where things actually happen.
Oh, I love your two quotes. You say, in games, rules and narrative are good. In social discourse, it destroys society. And you also say, giving points for social discourse is a disaster.
Yeah, because look, the things that make discourse healthy are the wide variety of values people bring to it, the fact that those values are preserved, the massive diversity of goals for discourse. Like, you could come to discourse with the goals of meeting people or understanding people or, like, coming to understand yourself or connecting. And, like, Twitter, again, the flatten, you reach for this word, and this word I think is the right word. Twitter, insofar as you take up its bargain and get motivated by its goals, Twitter flattens the landscape of values by offering everyone the same motivation, which is popularity, right?
Yeah, you articulate it really well. You start off wanting to say something profound and interesting and relevant, and then very subtly, you start getting caught up and getting retweets.
Yeah.
And very, you know, the slippery slope, all of a sudden you're playing the game. Instead of really having social discourse, your motivations, your value system has been co-opted.
Yep.
And you didn't even see it happen.
Yeah, and I mean, I just want to be clear. Twitter is a really technologized application of something that's, like, around, right? So it's not just Twitter. Journalists being motivated to get more clicks is one thing. Academics, like, academics are moving more and more towards being motivated by citation rates and various, like, quantitative assessments of how much their research was taken up. In each of these cases, there's a flattening of value and a narrowing of value that can be very satisfying if you take it up.
And so tie that back into, if you could, you've got the games and there's also the idea of quantification. And if you could spend a minute explaining that, right, how the hide evolved into the acre and what that meant.
Yeah. Now, one of the worries when I talk about this stuff, a lot of people ask, like, look, you sound like you're anti-number or like you're some anti-science person. And really, you're just talking about bad metrics. You're talking about, like, crappy measures. The answer here shouldn't be like stop measuring. It should be like get better measures. And I'm really worried about this. One of the reasons I'm worried is, I just want to be clear, like, so my claim isn't that, like, you shouldn't use numbers anywhere. Like, it's not like end science or something like that. My claim is, in particular, that when institutions, especially bureaucracies and technology companies, try to offer metrics for values, for our goals, then something screwy is going to happen. And that's because there's a tension, an essential tension, between the goals of quantification in large-scale institutions and the roles that our own values play in our own lives. So just to put it really quickly, like, I think we should, each of us does and should have very different values that are tailored to our own personality and our own emotional landscape.
Yes.
But so the standard view in the sociology of quantification, there's a really good literature on how bureaucracies work and the role of numbers in bureaucracy. The idea is that qualitative information, information that's like in words, basically, that's rich and subtle, travels badly between contexts. But quantified information has all the little nuances and strangenesses stripped out so that it can travel easily across context. So Theodore Porter, who's a historian of quantification, has this great example that you're mentioning. So he says, we used to measure land in terms of the hide, and a hide is very different from an acre. So a hide, he says, is the amount of land that's required to feed the average family. So a hide is very variable, right? A hide near a river is really small, and a hide in a forest is medium size, and a hide in a plain is big, and a hide in a desert is huge. But to know where the hides are, you have to be on the ground. You have to be basically a local enmeshed in the particular world. So one of the things he notes is when you shift from basically governments at the periphery to governments in the center, centralized bureaucracies, you get this motion from hides to acres. And that motion happens because the hide, which is a measure that demands a lot of sensitivity, can't be administered through a large-scale bureaucracy in which a lot of people who share no context have to quickly pass information. So one of the worries I have is that something like clicks, citation rates, steps for Fitbit, Twitter likes, those are information that's been framed to be understandable at the mass scale, at the largest scale. And it's done so by stripping out every little bit of individual nuance of value, right? It puts everyone on the same like standard value currency.
Right.
And so this is another case where I think, again, the theme that we keep returning to is that you're offered this the world offers you this trade, and you flatten out what you value. And you simplify it, and you get all these goods of like having the same value as everyone else and having a watch that can just measure it, or like an app that can just measure it.
Right. It's such a relief.
Yeah, it's such a relief. You don't have to explain yourself to other people. You know exactly. And this, I mean, you can be like, oh, my tweet went viral. See how many numbers? Or you can be like, oh, I lifted more today. Or, oh, I got in more steps today. Or, oh, like I got into the top-ranked law school instead of the 10th-ranked law school. I'm right. Better than you.
By right? These metrics.
Right, by these metrics.
And to, again, for a shout-out to Western philosophy, these ideas of quantification go back to the positivists, back to where, you know, the 1700s, where a guy like Charles Fourier almost talks King Louis into creating phalansteries, he thinks he's boiled humanity down to 800 plus distinct psychological types. And if he matches them just right and spreads them out in perfect little communities, then we have these little mini utopias. And that's a conversation for another thing another time is Western utopias and how they're sort of setting us up for dystopian thought. But that's another time. But the whole idea, once I encountered your idea of gamifications, I have to say, I just started seeing it everywhere.
Yeah.
And the thing that resonated with me, first, you had a personal confession that you were a game addict, shall I say.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a great bit. But also, you started thinking about your rock climbing. And here you go outside into the wilderness. You're in outdoors, and it's beautiful. And what are you doing? And when I go skiing or when I go kayaking, you know, I go into the outdoors, and am I sitting and absorbing? No, I've turned it into a game,
right.
And somehow I'm missing the point.
I'm not sure that – I don't want to go so far as saying like turning skiing or rock climbing into a game is missing the point. I mean, I think we can do these – so one of the things that's really interesting to me is that when I rock climb, the game makes me hyper-focus on certain details. And then when I come out of the rock climb and I sit down, I look at nature, I'm actually more aware of – nature.
So right. There's the good of gamification and the good of that interaction.
Yeah, the worry for me is about pervasiveness. So one of the things that makes this stuff okay and non-dominating is that when I rock climb, I'm like temporarily adopting that goal, right? I'm just in it for a while, and then I can switch to a different goal. The worry for me is, and also I get to choose my game, right? I can decide, I can do rock climbing for a while and see if that fits. And then I can do skiing for a while and see if that fits. And I can shift between these different goals and have some control over them. The worry with gamification for me is that the goals are pervasive and inflexible. Like, so my worry is that GPA, so I can try out rock climbing, and if that game fits me well, I can be in it for a while and then leave it. Or if I am not into it, I can be like, yeah, I'll try skiing, right? But with a GPA, I can't escape from it if I'm a student.
Right. Let's tie all of this together. We've got echo chambers, we've got moral outrage porn, we've got gamification where the lurking algorithms have sort of co-opted our values, and suddenly we realize that with moral outrage porn, we're getting four times the clicks than we were with trying to. So here's this whole landscape. Can you try to pull it all together for us? And then what we'll do is think about how we can apply that very quickly to maybe a solution once we see what the problem is.
I can't tie it together for you. I mean, I've been spending the last 6 months trying to turn all the stuff into a proposal for a pop book. And if I could tie this together neatly for you, then that proposal would already be out the door to an agent. But I instead have what you're not seeing off screen is whiteboards and whiteboards of, you know, like serial killer scrawl. No, I mean, so you can see some core themes. The core themes are that reality is hard, morality is hard, and there are all these systems that offer us simplifications. Yeah, so in each of these cases, what you get is some kind of offered trade-off where your values are thick and difficult, morality is thick and difficult, believing and adjusting your belief to the evidence is thick and difficult. And then there's systems or technologies or promises that offer you to flatten out this stuff, make it easier, and it's more pleasurable, it's more delicious, and that's the trade I'm worried about.
You said two things earlier that seemed new to me. One of the things is that Western philosophy is, on a larger scale, Western society is hyper-focused on the individual to the detriment of being aware of community. And there's a writer getting a lot of attention, rightfully so, Robin Wall Kimmerer, where she's taking botany and science and saying, wait a minute, these things are interconnected. You can't dissect the frog to understand how a frog works. You need to look at a living frog in a living frog's community. So you brought up the idea that we're in a community, and within that, in terms of what's new, and first, before we do that, I have to give a shout out to Plato in terms of what's old and new. It's like, okay, is this new? Is our current anxieties about nuclear holocaust and COVID and climate change, is it really any different than living on the steppes and knowing that Attila the Hun is coming? You know, is that anxiety really the same? So Plato's cave analogy, I mean, he really touched on a lot of the things that we're talking about here. So you've got people mesmerized by the shadows. And if you don't, we have a link in our show notes. We'll link to all of this in our show notes. So you have people mesmerized by the shadows on the wall. Nothing about shadows is that they have the shape of the original thing. It's not just, again, the Orwellian doublespeak. There's a real shape of that thing on the wall, and it's moving. There's motion. You know, there's something to keep you attention. And it seems like such a simple task. You just want to turn them around to look out the front of the cave. It's just, hey, turn around. So a quick shout out to our guy Plato in terms of saying, well, is anything really new here or not? But I think your idea of taking this community and saying, wait a minute, we have to look at this community, and that this community is disembodied. We're not physically together sitting around the campfire looking at each other. We are sitting here looking at screens at best, but if not, we're ripping our moral outrage porn off the and ripping these people that we have no contact with and don't know their parents or their kids or their lives. And we're just ripping this stuff off of the keyboards. And it's a dangerous combination of having a disembodied community. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
There are a few. I mean, I keep getting worried about the parallels here. I mean, you're really concerned about how easy it is for people to rip each other online. And I'm still not sure that that's a sufficient sign that something's gone wrong. Because, I mean, this is the thing we had before where, look, the fact that there's moral outrage isn't necessarily a sign that it's moral outrage porn, right? The fact that it's moral outrage could be well justified. The fact that people are online ripping other people could be because they've been emboldened by the anonymity and the system, or to say crazy stuff, or it could be that they're making appropriate moral moves towards appropriate social change, and that the fact that anonymity protects them from punishment in this case is good, right? And the fact that it's easier to organize people is online is good. So the characterization of like one of the reasons. So we've been through a lot of stuff where it sounds like what I want to say is like, look, the technology is really problematic here, and it's a core mover. But I'm still not sure that's even close to a complete story. It's one story you can tell, and one of the reasons is because if that were the story, then you should expect the effect to be symmetrical across all places that use that technology. But we don't see that. So if you look at the book Network Propaganda by Benkler and a bunch of other researchers, one of the things they document is that so first of all, there's radical asymmetry in the media consumption networks between like the right-wing world around Fox News and Breitbart and the rest of the media environment. They also document that like the effect that you're seeing isn't consistent across countries. Some countries have these wild breakaway like things and other ones don't. So if you were like, look, the anonymity of the online world and the facelessness is driving this thing, then you should expect equal amounts of out of control action across the political spectrum and from country to country, but you don't. So, okay. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I don't, like, I'm really worried about claiming that anything I've said is a complete answer. And I'm worried that it is, that I'm worried that I've offered something seductively clear and you're like, oh, I can just, but really, like, the data doesn't fit. The story, I think, is a part of the story, but I don't think it can be complete because there's all the stuff in the world that we can't explain, like radical asymmetry between countries.
So
you're not seeing this in Japan, for example. Like, right. Japan is just as technologized as America, and there's not a, like, MAGA of Japan. That needs explaining.
So I'd like to that's a hopeful note that I'd like to quash. You mentioned let's equate if we could, and if you accept this, that echo chambers are very cult-like, and we're trying to destroy the evil actor and turn people in Plato's cave around so they see the light. And do you accept that the cult echo chamber thing, and we're trying to break through this somehow?
Yeah, I'm not sure if the Plato analogy is. I can see where you're finding the analogy useful, but I mean, the.
It's part of the nothing's new idea that you put out earlier. It's like, yeah, this
is
part of us.
I find a lot more roots in Descartes. So basically, I'm hesitating here. This is my like philosophy professor wonk side. That's just like, look. Plato's analogy of the cave was based on this very specific metaphysical picture where there were eternal forms that were unchanging and perfect,
right,
and the shadows were of the changeable. And so if you think that there is his thing makes sense, if you think there's an eternal form of like human that is unmutable and unchanging, and like that's, I mean, that image is a very catchy image because it's like, oh, some of us have the light and the rest of you are lost to it. But the actual discussion around it, I think depends on this very particular metaphysics that we don't share.
Okay.
I find a lot more roots in Descartes.
Okay.
Because Descartes worry a lot of the time, so people are like, so Descartes, I mean, everyone knows about Descartes' evil demon, like, there's an evil demon maybe tricking me about everything. But if you look in the first meditations, the reason he tells himself to imagine that is because he's trying to scrub himself of all his thoughts. And the reason he's trying to scrub them is because he thinks he's been misinformed from his youth, and he doesn't know how far that spread. And sometimes I teach this, and my students are like, oh my God, what happened to Descartes? Like, what hurt him that he has to do this wild thing? And the answer is, literally, he found out the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. Like, we're in the period of the Enlightenment, where we were like, oh shit!
Guess right? What?
So the idea that there's systematic misinformation that may have pervaded everything and that you may have to start over, that I take to be the root of a lot of the stuff that I'm thinking about. And that's not based on some weird wonky metaphysics that most of us don't accept anymore. That's just based on someone being like, holy shit, my entire belief system was built on a foundation that's just been shaken. And I think that's the thing. That's the core that I find useful.
And you use the phrase epistemological reboot, which I love. Yep. But let's, for a minute, I want to spend a minute with Black and Stevenson to wind up. You in your Aeon article, you talk about how a neo-Nazi named Black is brought out of that particular echo chamber by very intensive sensitivity, empathy, and trust building by another man named Stevenson, who spends a lot of time, and finally Black emerges from the neo-Nazi echo chamber. And I want to read something that you wrote, and I'd like you to, in terms of a way forward, because we're always looking for a way forward, and this is how you conclude that article about how to get out of this. But the path I'm describing is a winding, narrow, and fragile one. There is no guarantee that such trust can be established and no clear path to its being established systematically. And even given all that, what we found here isn't an escape route at all. It depends on the intervention of another. This path is not even one an echo chamber member can, on her own, undertake. It is only a whisper-thin hope for rescue from the outside.
Yep. So if a lot of the worries we have here are about getting caught up in a simplified system that like resets your trust, and if the trust settings are continuing to drive this stuff forward, then we need to repair that shattered trust. And so the piece ends with one story I found about one isolated incident where one person managed to pull another person through like this long, weird, intense friendship, where basically a Jewish guy kept inviting this white supremacist guy over to his dinner until, like, years later, the white supremacist guy was like, wait, I can't, right? This is, what do I do? I mean, some caveats about the story. One, this is a single story of a positive thing. We don't know if this kind of intervention would work systematically. Two, it's a kind of random and personal one. And I don't, like, again, people keep wanting to be like, so how do you scale this up to a policy level? And I don't know. Like, I think about this all the time because I'm a teacher, right? And I teach, I can tell that there are white supremacists in my class. And I have, now, this isn't just abstract thinking. This is like, I need to figure out how to rebuild trust. They're in my classroom every day. And the answer is, I haven't figured it out yet. Like, I don't know what the systematic way to rebuild trust is. Sometimes some people get lucky or have this right circumstance and they can do it. But my worry currently is that it's really easy to break trust in the large scale for Rush Limbaugh to like reorient the trust of a huge amount of Americans. But restoring trust is really, really difficult. And I think you were hoping for a note of hope. Here's my note of hope. People listening, this is an important thing to work on. If you're out there and you're working in technology, you're working in psychology, you're working in the sciences, you're working in education, trying to figure out how to systematically rebuild trust is massively important. And I'm just like a philosopher who like figured out a few intellectual, like a conceptual analysis of like the notion of an echo chamber. I'm not an empiricist who can like actually figure out what policies in the world would restore broken trust. But I can tell you, like, I think that's where the problem is. That's where we should be focusing attention.
Wow. What a pleasure and a joy to listen to and watch your mind work, T. Your writings and thoughts have changed the way I see things. And I'm really grateful for the work you're doing.
You're encouraging me to, I mean, one of my possibilities is turning this material into a pop book. Like I said, like, I still actually don't know what, I mean, it's just this wild sprawl, but your interest is encouraging to me that I should actually do that.
All your ideas are very visual. Yeah. And I can see them being very visually expressed and communicated. Anyway, I'm so grateful for your time. And
thanks, man.
And you know, we come visit us. We have rocks down here, you know, in Zion National Park. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
That was the philosopher T. Nguyen. Thanks for laying out that map for us, T. Our show is produced by Ben Kilbourne and myself. Our theme music is by The Observatory, thank you. Thanks to my friend Joe Kinzel for our ongoing conversations about our time together in the Soviet Union. Thank you, Town of Springdale, the Washington County Rap Tax Commission, the Utah Division of Arts and Museums, the O.C. Tanner and Eccles Foundations for your faith and support. It really helps. And if you're listening through iTunes, please leave us a comment. It boosts our visibility. Thanks. Insight is the podcast of the Zion Canyon Mesa, an arts and humanities residency by Zion National Park. We hope to start hosting residents soon, this year anyway. So keep in touch with our website, zioncanyonmesa.org. Pretty soon, we'll have a submissions portal. So if you're a writer, painter, photographer, musician, or somewhere in there, we look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Logan Hebner. Please stay safe out there.